This is Angela Knappenberger interviewing Peter Littweiler on Saturday, February 6, 2016. I'm in the Bryant Room of the Rahner Special Collections Library. It is 10:04 when we're starting our interview. Mr. Littweiler, can you give your full name and date of birth?
Peter Edward Littweiler, October 5th, 1942.
And where were you born, Mr. Littweiler?
In Winchester, Massachusetts, just north of Boston.
Great. And what were your parents' names?
Clarence Seward Littweiler, class of 24. And my mother's name was Sarah Louise Holcomb Littweiler. She was a Cornell grad, and I believe she graduated in 25.
Wow, so Ivy League in your blood.
And
can you tell me...
Disappointed I didn't go there.
Well, your father was a Dartmouth alum then.
Right, yes.
I'm sure he was very excited you were going here then.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have any siblings?
I had four older siblings, one of which passed away long before I was born. Was died within 2 weeks. So I had three siblings as I grew up.
And tell me a little bit about your childhood. What kind of town did you grow up in?
I grew up in a town called Winchester, which is a very nice bedroom community of Boston and heavily high education levels. I'd say out of our class at Winchester High School, out of 250, I'm guessing 220, went on to some four-year college. And in my particular class, three went to Dartmouth, and at least three or four that I can think of went to Harvard, and probably 20 went to Ivy League boys' schools, and probably 15 went to the equivalent women's schools.
Okay, so what was that like growing up? Were academics very heavily enforced from a young age, or was it a little less stressful than that?
Well, I don't even remember it being stressful.
Okay.
I know I did my homework and wasn't one to procrastinate and enjoyed using the library, but also enjoyed playing multiple sports and socializing and being a class officer and working and, you know, just kept busy, didn't have all the stresses that kids have today.
Yeah, what kind of sports were you active with?
In high school, it was football, hockey, and I think I did some golf, but not very much.
Mm-hmm.
I was a caddy, so I drifted towards golf.
And you said you were a class officer. Was this in high school as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm. All three out of the 4 years, I think.
And what? Any other sort of activities that you enjoyed, whether it was extracurriculars through school or any sort of personal hobbies, anything like that?
Let's see. I was in Boy Scouts for a little bit. Didn't stay very active. I worked as a caddy for several summers and then ran a caddy camp in New Hampshire when I was at Dartmouth. I did that in the summertime. Seemed every year I'd have a different girlfriend. Pretty normal back then, I guess.
Sounds like you were having a really great childhood. Did you know from an early age that you would be applying to either Dartmouth or Cornell or any of the other Ivy Leagues?
Yeah, that was my goal, and they had a program back there, not very well known, but the earlier your application went in, then the better room selection you would get if you got in. So I applied when I was a freshman.
As a freshman in high school?
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't be, you just filled out an application just to get in line. And then when you were seniors, then you did everything. But that gave you a very high, you could select the room you wanted and then better choice of getting your roommates or whatever.
Oh, wow. So was Dartmouth was your first choice since you were a freshman in high school?
Yeah, I did early admission and got in. And I did go to Cornell, really liked it. It's just not more than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so then let's move on to your college years. Can you tell me the year that you were starting at Dartmouth?
Yeah, 1960.
And tell me a little bit about your time there. What was it like moving? I guess you were still on the East Coast, but was it a big change for you?
No, because we had a summer place in New Hampshire, and I had been to Dartmouth many times. And I had an event. The hockey team had an event called Sons of Alumni, so probably four different times between the ages of 13 and 16, I'd come to Hanover with my dad to play in that. You didn't have to be good, you just had to be a son of alumni. So the transition was pretty easy for me, and my good friend in high school, I convinced him that the freshman year we ought to just go our separate ways and meet new people. And so we were in the same dormitory, one floor apart. We stayed very close, but we both regretted our decision.
Well, did you get a good room since you...
I had two good roommates, but we weren't real strong friends socially outside of our dorm room. Mm-hmm. But we all made it through, and we'd stay in touch a little bit. I stay in touch with one of them a lot, the other not at all.
But what were their names?
Hal, H-A-L, Weiler, W-E-I-L-E-R, and Dave Larson, L-A-R-S-O-N.
And who was your friend from high school?
Bob Freeman.
Okay.
And both my on to become doctors.
So I'm sure they were studying lots of science.
Yeah, they were. And that was not my high point.
What was your major at Dartmouth?
Technically, it's economics, but I majored in Spanish. And then I did the 3-2 program, if you're familiar with that.
I'm not. What is that?
Okay, the 3-2 program was something that I don't know if they have anymore. If you had good grades and a good profile, you could go to Tuck School or Thayer School during your senior year, and you moved down onto their campus. So I, in essence, had to give up my senior year but save the year of schooling, but I still had to go to what they called the Great Issues course, which was, I think, once a month a speaker would come and would have to listen to him and then write a report or something. Mm-hmm. So I was a Spanish major, and I studied overseas in Salamanca. And my friend from Winchester, Bob Freeman, he was also a Spanish major, and we both were there at the same time. That was like fall of 62.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. And we both, he and I both joined Phi Delta fraternity. He played freshman basketball, and I played freshman hockey and football, but never played any actual games. I was too low on the totem pole. And then the sophomore year, I started playing rugby, and I played that the rest of my college, even through graduate school.
Did you see playing time with rugby out on the field?
Yeah, I eventually became the captain of the rugby team, and we had a trip to Hanover, Germany, what was called Hands Across the Ocean, and it was a federally recognized program, so I got a little bit of help arranging it and getting access to different things, and then alumni helped pay our way, and we paid our way as well. Played in Germany and Scotland.
Wow, so you got to travel quite a bit during your college years.
Yeah, that was all one trip. But the rugby club itself traveled around the East Coast to play teams. And it wasn't a funded program then, and it isn't now. So you had to drive to each game with teammates.
Great. And during your time at Dartmouth, 60 to your graduating year, 64, I see that it says you were at Dartmouth until 65. Was there any reason for that?
Yeah, because I did the 3-2 program.
Okay, so
my last 2 years were at the Amos Tuck School. And what transpired actually was, as I was ending my junior year, my dad suddenly passed away. And that was at the same time I'd been selected. About 2 weeks later, I was selected captain of the rugby team and the rush chairman for fraternity. And then the dean from Tuck School called me and said that if I were interested, they would accept me into the 3-2 program, even though I hadn't applied. But apparently my uncle, who was a graduate of Dartmouth and Tuck School even earlier than my dad, he had called just to inquire. That's what I did. I went directly to Tuck School and bypassed my senior year, which was a fun year you all look forward to, but I never did that. And it was probably the best thing to do to save me a year's education.
Yeah. Okay, so during this time, sort of getting into the Vietnam-related part of this narrative, during your time at Dartmouth, had you heard anything about Vietnam? Was campus talking about the war or any sort of conflict at the time?
I don't recall it being high profile. I, as a junior, got enrolled in the Army ROTC program.
Okay.
And stayed in that for about a year, but because of my summer job being vital to getting through college financially, I had to drop out of ROTC. But I know by the time I was in my second year of grad school, it was becoming more evident that at some point one might get called up. But I was what was called, 4F, I think, because I had injured my back playing fraternity hockey. And so I was not fit to be drafted. And then there was a famous case. Remember who Muhammad Ali was, the boxer?
Right, yeah, of course.
Okay, back then he was known as Cassius Clay. And he had the same classification I did. And they, without any further exams, changed his classification and thousands of others, including mine.
So I became
eligible for the draft. And about a year after I graduated from grad school, my number came up, and that's when I first started thinking seriously of the best way to use my time and service.
Do you think that the fact that you had been in ROTC had any sort of effect on you being called into draft, or was it part of the random pull?
Oh, no, I think it's all random. I don't think it had anything to do with it, but I obviously had a very positive outlook towards the service. I tried to get into the Navy and got turned down because of my back. And then, obviously, when the draft came, I just waited, but I did sign up for what they call as a college officer candidate program. So if you had a college degree, you were guaranteed to get into officer candidate school as long as you could past basic training, advanced training.
Mm-hmm. Just before we move on to your time being drafted, why had you joined ROTC when you were at Dartmouth? Was there a particular interest in the service before, or was it part of any other sort of program?
It was twofold. One, I enjoyed the idea of going into the service, and it also provided funding. I just hadn't thought about the way it would necessitate not having a full-time summer job. I just couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So that's why I had to give it up.
Okay.
When I graduated from Dartmouth, I did go to work for Delphore for a little over a year, and even asked if they wanted me to try to get a deferment or anything, and they thought it was a good idea for that. So I said, that's fine.
So can you tell me a little bit about when you were drafted? Do you remember the day or the moment that it happened?
I remember my mother called me and said, draft board head, who was a friend of hers, called her and said, you know, your son's got about 3 months before he gets drafted. So then I went down to the Pittsburgh recruiting office and signed up for this officer candidate school program.
So did you have a chance to work between graduation and being drafted?
Yeah, I worked for a little over a year with Gulfport, Pittsburgh.
With what? Pardon, sorry? Where did you work?
With Gulf Oil.
Oh, okay.
In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay. So you were working, and now you were drafted. And what was the process after that? What did you have to go through to get ready for training, to say, you know, to talk to your family about it?
Yeah, technically I didn't get drafted. I knew I was going to be drafted, so I enlisted in this college OCS program, guaranteed.
Oh, okay.
And at that time I was engaged to the woman who became my wife, and we talked about it. She had a job, and she was going to be living with her folks. She had lived in she stayed living with her folks.
How did you meet?
After a rugby practice, another Dartmouth rugby player and I went and saw these good-looking ladies in a cocktail lounge and asked them out.
Oh, well, that worked out very nicely for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so she would be living with her parents, and you were engaged. You didn't plan to get married before leaving.
No, we talked about that, and it would have been just too much of a rush.
Right. So then, did you get a chance to stop by home, talk to your family before going off to basic training?
No, and at that point it was just my mother. My dad had already passed away.
Oh, yes. And your siblings, I'm sure, were out working.
She knew I was going, and I never even thought of a special trip to see my mother.
Oh. Well, then let's get on to basic training. Where were you training at first?
Yeah, the first 8 weeks was at Fort Jackson in Columbia, South Carolina.
And was that part of the officer training program? Did you have...
No. You had to get through 2 8-week basic training and advanced training for infantry in order to be eligible for OCS. You had to successfully pass those, and then you were automatically involved in OCS with this particular program.
Right, and this was for Army infantry?
Yes.
Infantry. Okay. So what was that like, this training in Fort Jackson at first?
Well, I'm glad that I had played sports most of my life and was in decent shape. but it was a very a lifestyle I wasn't used to, living in the barracks, and you know, being told when to get up and when to go to bed, and what to do, and being exhausted pretty much every day. But it taught you the importance of learning how to do things their way and how to depend on other teammates, and that I understood from sports. So my sports background helped a lot.
Okay, and then how about the next 8 weeks?
Yeah, the next 8 weeks. I think that was also at Fort Jackson, just a different part. That was called Advanced Infantry Training. And it was just everything that cranked up a little bit more, and a lot more focus on Vietnam. It was pretty obvious that anybody that graduated at some point was going to be going to Vietnam. Training was a little more focused towards eventual combat.
What had you heard about Vietnam leading up to this before, either at the base or before when you were enrolling or when you were signing up? What did you know about the
war? I knew there was a lot of disagreement on the war. I had heard about what they call the domino theory as to why we were in the war, that if Vietnam fell to communism, so would Laos and Cambodia and who knows what else. And there was some demonstrations against it, but nothing large until the Kent State event, and I don't recall the year, whether that was while I was in or before I went in, but it was right around that time when some of the students were injured, and I'm not sure if one didn't get killed. I don't recall.
Okay, so then during your next 8 weeks, you got through that. So you got through your two mandated basic training sessions, and then were you enrolled in a specific program where you'd be with fellow college graduate officers?
Well, officer candidates, right.
Officer candidates, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we were all taken to Fort Benning, not in the same bus because some came from different other forts from their training, but I can remember the very first time we were formed out in front of our building, and we were called the 93rd Infantry Company at Fort Benning OCS.
In Georgia.
Yes. And I believe there was like 120 officer candidates, and we were standing in formation, having just dropped our bags and stuff inside the building, or we had them with us, one or the other. And the captain, who was called our tactical officer, or TO, and he would be in charge of us for the next 6 months to try to make us officers. His name was Captain Paris, and just an awesome leader. But the first thing he said was, this is like 5:30 in the afternoon. Okay. Is there any Ivy League graduates? I want them to come out and stand front and center. And I knew that was not a good thing.
Interesting.
Three of us stepped forward, and all three of us happened to be athletic. One went to Harvard. I went. I can't remember what the third one went to. And he said, okay, drop and give me 30. And then drop on the ground and give me 30 push-ups. And so while we were doing that, he was talking to everybody else and said, now, from now on, when we do anything physical, these gentlemen will have to do more than you.
Wow, why was that?
Who knows, but it was great because, you know, we had the academic skills. I had good leadership skills. And by the time I was done, I was in better shape than I'd ever been. And I thanked him
all
for that. It was something I didn't like when he said it, but it turned out to be great.
Right. Wow. So what was that like? Was there any sort of, you know, the other, I guess, that would they have been cadets or soldiers? Was there any sort of attempt to isolate the Ivy Leagues or any sort of?
No, not at all. No, everybody kind of, you knew that if you worked with other people, they might help you. If you didn't, it'll come back to bite you. And everybody wanted everybody else to succeed. And everybody had you were in two-man rooms. And it was like being a freshman at West Point. There were a lot of things you couldn't do. Like you couldn't eat candy. You couldn't have any candy sent to you in the mail or cookies or anything like that. If you did, you had to turn them over to the tactical officer. You couldn't step on the floor. You had to put your hands on the transom as you came into your room and swing onto your bed and get over to your desk.
Wow.
Your floor had to be polished at all times. And if you were walking down the hall on a rubber mat, upperclassman or an officer came by, you had to jump to the side, and your uniform and everything had to be stick and span, everything in your trunk had to be laid out a particular way, and everything was ordered and disciplined.
And so this was for 6 months.
Yeah, and if I thought that basic training was difficult, this jumped to an entirely new level. And it was during this time that my wife and I also decided that during Christmas break we'd get married back in Pittsburgh. And I had a total of 3 days.
Oh, wow. So did she plan most of it and then you arrived?
She was a professional caterer and food supervisor, so she prepared all the food for the reception back at her parents' house.
And that's
nice. We got married, and the next night we spent in Pittsburgh, got a hotel, and left early the next morning in a snowstorm to drive back to Fort Benning.
Wow. That was very rushed.
And we had been able to arrange to get an apartment with two bedrooms with another couple that they were already married, so I had to go back and live in the barracks, obviously, and got to see my wife some weekends, but not a lot. Yeah, maybe.
Would she come down, or would you drive? Would she come down to Georgia?
She came back to Fort Benning and shared an apartment with another.
Oh,
couple.
Okay.
Every time I'd see her, I'd drop off my uniforms. She learned to starch them and polish the boots and stuff. Help me get through it.
Well, how long had you been at Fort Benning when you got married, and then how long did she have living on the base with you?
Just about halfway, 3 months.
Okay.
We had been there, and then 3 months before I graduated.
Okay. And so when you graduated, what happened next?
Well, you fill out what's called a dream sheet, like a month before you graduate. Mm-hmm. And you select the branch that you want. And unless it's full, you get that. Then you try to pick where you could go. And I asked to go to language school because I had scored extremely high, but I got turned down. I wanted to be an Army intelligence, which I was selected for, and then they sent me to Fort Hulleberg outside of Baltimore, Maryland, which is now federal prison.
Oh.
Back then it was a nice small fort.
When you say the dream sheet was to pick a branch, do you mean a branch within the Army, or?
Yeah, within the Army.
Okay.
I think technically you could have asked to become a Marine, because you had all the trappings of a Marine. That would have been hard to do, I think, but I had no interest in that. But yeah, did you want to be in artillery or infantry or intelligence or logistics? Or there were like 15 different branches you could go into. And you're right, they're not called branches. But
okay. And when you graduate, did you graduate with an officer title?
Yes, you started as a second lieutenant.
Okay. So, sorry, please continue where you were. You'd filled out your dream sheet.
Yeah, and then I think like a week before you graduate, they tell you where you're going. And so my wife and I loaded up our car and what few things we headed off to Baltimore. And that was nice because we could then get back to Pittsburgh or Boston on one or two weekends before I had to ship off to Vietnam.
It was nice. And what was Baltimore like?
It was a fun city. I don't think I've ever been there before, and we made some new friends. And we were making just enough money to pay the rent and not much more because she wasn't working because it was too hard for 3 months to get a job. So we just enjoyed each other and had a good time.
And when did you know that you would be going to Vietnam?
Oh, I think within 3 weeks after starting intelligence school. It wasn't long.
And did they tell you how long you had before you were deploying?
Yes. I think 2 days after completing the course, I had tickets ready to go to Vietnam.
And so did your wife... Oh, sorry. Did your wife stay in Baltimore? Or?
No. She went back to live with her family because it was pretty clear there was nothing to come back to Fort Hulleberg to unless you were going to teach. There wasn't much in the way of active operations or anything there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then let's talk about Vietnam. Can you tell me about getting ready to actually leave the country and go to Vietnam and that flight there?
Sure. First of all, on my Army records at that point, it was still stamped unfit for combat because of my back injury. Mm-hmm. Even though I'd made it through OCS, which is pretty physically demanding, so I assumed I'd be working in Saigon in a military intelligence unit, probably involved with computers and analysis and stuff. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I talked. They asked you to fill out a will, which I did. And we both were pretty upbeat that nothing negative would happen, which is pretty naive, but you know, newlyweds can think that way. Trying to think what else. I don't recall any significant farewell party. We just did a few things with friends that we had in Pittsburgh at the time. I went back and talked with Gulf Oil and told them I'd be leaving. And they made it clear my job would be there, even though it was 3 years away. At that point, it would be about 2 years away.
So you knew how long you would be in Vietnam, 2 years at that time, they told you?
No. Back in those days, the standard tour was a year, 365 days exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to stay more, they would encourage that, and you'd get what's called a re-enlistment bonus. Even for an officer, you'd get maybe $10,000 or something like that. And then you'd have to agree to stay in the service at least another 2 more years. So I knew I had a minimum of a year in Vietnam and then about 9 months left on my military commitment somewhere in the state.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, but you knew you'd have a job when you got back, which...
Yes, I didn't have any concerns like today's veteran tent. By the way, if you're interested, we can get into it more at the end if it's of any interest. But today I do a lot of volunteer work with veterans in Tulsa.
Veterans of Vietnam or veterans in general?
Just in general, I'm happening to work closely with a Vietnam vet that was there about the same time that had lots of problems with him. Became a drug addict.
Uh-huh.
And then ended up in court, and that's how I got to meet him.
That is rough. Back to your timeline. What year was this then that you left for Vietnam?
I think it was 67. And I was, if you can find the date of the Tet Offensive, if you backtrack 7 months, that's kind of when I started, and 5 months after the Tet Offensive is when I departed.
Okay. It says here that you served in the Army from 1966 to 1969.
Yeah, so I think I went over in like July of 67 and came back in June of 68, something like that.
Okay. What was it like?
What was it like?
Sorry, no. The connection gave out a little bit. I guess we can talk about that. What was it like landing in with, just start from the beginning?
Yeah, we flew on a regular, I think it was a TWA flight, but they were all chartered flights. So everybody there flew from, I think it was Los Angeles. Everybody on the flight was going to what was called Tan Sanut Air Base outside of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And the base itself, I think, was called Long Binh, Longbinh. Why I remember that, I don't know. And you basically land there and spend about 3 or 4 days being issued clothing and instructions, etc., and then you get shipped to your unit.
So you said that you landed about 7 months after the Tet Offensive started? Is that correct?
7 months before.
Before, okay. So the Tet Offensive started at the beginning of 1968, so you would have landed in 1967?
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Like something like August. Early August 67 and finished in July 68 or something like that.
Okay. Sorry, just to get some clarity on the date there. So then, where were you stationed at first after those first few days on the bases?
I reported into the Military Intelligence Command in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there for probably 3 days to go through orientation and find out where I was being sent. And they sent me to the northernmost part of Vietnam, Quang Tri, Q-U-A-N-G, and then another word, T-R-I.
And what were you doing up there?
It was part of what was called the Military Assistance Command Vietnam, MACV.
Mm-hmm.
And I was to go up there basically documented as a civilian.
And was that because you weren't technically fit for combat, an officer?
I'll cover the combat. At first, I did complain to the commanding officer that I had my first interview with, and I said, "No, you're sending me into the high combat region, and my profile says unfit for combat." And he said, "Well, you'll need to take that up with your senator or something. As far as I'm concerned, you're fit for combat." And then his next question was, "Do you have any Vietnam language ability. And I said, no, but that's where I wanted to get. And I showed him, he looked up my profile. I said, man, I can't believe they didn't send you to language school. Mm-hmm. He said, we don't need officers. We need officers that speak Vietnamese. So, you know, the typical large corporation or large organization, the Army wanted me there quickly, and the people that needed me wanted me with different skill sets.
Oh.
So I went up to Vietnam, to Quang Tri, to further develop a intelligence network as civilians, and we were documented as U.S. aid workers.
Was this to sort of avoid any kind of suspicion, or was it just common practice to have you enrolled as a civilian? I guess I'm a bit...
We were supposed to blend in with other aid agency people.
Okay, got it.
Seen as intelligence officers, and three of us lived in a house, and agents that we were running would come in there, or we'd meet them in other places, we'd prepare reports and send them out. But then we also had full access to the military compound, which was walking distance. But so did every aid person, and many of those were truly members of the U.S. aid group.
And what was your job as an intelligence officer while you were...
You developed and analyzed intelligence reports to develop agents, etc.
And were the Vietnamese people that you were in contact with, can you tell me a little bit about them?
I don't remember very much about them when I was working with MACNIC, to be honest. And that all changed about 2 months before Tet Offensive.
Tell me about that change.
Yeah, they came up with a program that was called the Phoenix program, like the city or like the bird that rose from the ashes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back to Saigon for 5 days of training. And this was, I think, a much smarter way to operate the intelligence operations. As an American in Vietnam, basically your job was to work with other existing agencies, mainly Vietnamese agencies, and provide them guidance and funding and direction. And so I left Quang Tri and went further north to a much smaller town, village, and lived in a compound with Vietnamese.
And were you working on your... How were your language skills at this point? Were you still working on your language, on Vietnamese?
Yeah, what I did was I helped teach English at an elementary school that was walking distance from the compound. And by doing that, I forced myself to learn a little bit of Vietnamese, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived in a compound and shared a bunkhouse, I guess you'd call it, with five other military advisors, a major, a captain, another lieutenant, and three sergeants. And our job was to work with the Vietnamese and teach them things around our skill level. And these, the people who lived in the compound were like National Guard people. They would work their fields and be with their families during the day. And then around 7 o'clock, they'd come into the compound. So I ran...
And what were you teaching them? Like you said, at your skill level, what exactly did that mean?
Yeah, that was teaching and working with different intelligence agencies like the Provincial Reconnaissance Unit and the local police, and I don't know, there were like 7 or 8 different agencies. And then I'd also deal with the 1st Cavalry, and then moved into the area and helped set up operations based on my intelligence that I would provide.
And this was all through the Phoenix program?
Yes, and this was about a month and a half before the Tet Offensive. And I'd say about a month before that, I was sending in reports that there was a significant buildup north of the demilitarized zone and approaching where we were.
So you could sort of sense the rumblings that were happening before the Tet Offensive?
Well, we had agents who were getting reports from too. I would debrief them, or they would debrief by the Mason and give me the report.
Sorry, the audio sort of went funny there. Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah. We had agents that we had that were reporting to us, and they would either verbally sit with me or with the Vietnamese and provide intelligence that we would then submit into Saigon. And that's where we were getting the intelligence from.
And did that intelligence sort of give any hint towards the Tet Offensive?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure other Phoenix officers were getting the same thing.
How was your time then affected once the Tet Offensive started, both as someone living in Vietnam, the northern part of Vietnam, and as an intelligence officer?
And also, by the way, I at this point I was wearing combat fatigues, as they call it, mm-hmm. and I had no insignia. No one would know I was an officer. Intelligence. I just looked like a normal PFC without any rank on my shirt.
And PFC would be?
Private First Class. Enlisted man. So I'd never been under fire or in shot at or anything like that prior to the Tet Offensive. And after the Tet Offensive, that particular night, or the day of the before, we had a New Year's or Tet celebration inside the compound for all the locals in heaven. Long tables set up, and the district chief gave a talk in Vietnamese. He was a Vietnamese himself and in the military. And it was just a day of celebration. And then that night, around 3 o'clock in the morning, all the electricity was off. We had generators, and they had been sabotaged. Mm-hmm. And then incoming mortars started, and then machine gun fire and rockets.
And this was your first experience being under fire?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
And we were surrounded on, I think, two sides. But the good news was the 1st Cavalry had moved into that region, you know, within 50 miles, about 2 weeks earlier because of all the intelligence reports. Mm-hmm. So we were able to call on them, and they had helicopter gunships. And they
how many miles were they away?
I don't know exactly. They were within 50 miles. My helicopter
50 or 15, sorry.
Yeah, 50.
Oh, okay. I'm sure with helicopters that's not...
Yeah, they could be there within 10 minutes. They were able to... We had, you know, barbed wire out in the fields to stop anything, but that didn't stop them sending mortars in or firing rockets. Mm-hmm. But the 1st Cav came and kept them from overrunning us. And machine gun nest that we had built up on top of our building that we lived in. Not a building, it was a bunker. and they were, it was being operated by two or three Vietnamese soldiers, and that North Vietnamese rocket hit right between the two of them and exploded behind them. They didn't get injured, but they, there was no way they would, they came running down the stairs and exploded the Vietnamese. They weren't going back up there. Mm-hmm. So the two of us got, without talking to each other or without thinking about it, but running up the stairs, and together we manned the machine gun and started shooting out across the field as we could see things. Mm-hmm. And about 2 months later, we both received a Vietnamese Award of Valor or something like that. But the important thing is not that I did it, but that my training was so intense, I never even thought about what a stupid thing that was to do.
Yeah.
You just did it. And it had to be done, and it wasn't something to delegate. There wasn't anybody to delegate it to. You couldn't ask another Vietnamese to go up there because they were mm-hmm. fighting, and we just went up there. That was another pivotal point, plus for the first cast. And mm-hmm. while I was doing some of that, I had a cassette recorder going, sending a message to my wife. That's how we communicated back then. We send cassettes back and forth.
Mm-hmm. And did so, that have a recording of the machine gun, or?
Yeah, or the mortars and things like that. My wife said it terrified me later. But she was glad that she got off alive. So.
That's, yeah, no problem. Okay, so the Tet Offensive has started. Does this attack, does that sort of signal like a shift in day-to-day life on the base?
I wouldn't call it a base. This was maybe a half mile by a half mile facility with 120 Vietnamese inside it and 8 Americans and 1 Australian. But yeah, we, from that point on, I would do patrols going into villages as part of the Phoenix program to identify, capture, or eliminate North Vietnamese, or I'm trying to remember what the South Vietnamese were called that were not pro Vietnam. Can't remember it. But anyways.
So do you mean like the Viet Cong?
Viet Cong, that's it. Yeah, we're trying to eliminate North Vietnamese or Viet Cong or political leaders.
And did that happen very often? I mean, did you come across?
At least twice a week.
Okay. And what would you do with the captured persons?
Generally, in the ones that we did, we would arrest people or would gain more intelligence or would try to turn them into agents.
Mm-hmm. And was that done all on your half-mile by half-mile building, or would you go to larger base?
As far as interviewing them?
As far as any sort of dealings with them?
Yeah, the patrol sometimes would do things here out in the field. I mean, we might walk or drive, well, there'd have to be a walk, 5 or 10 miles to get to wherever we were going, and then some of the operations I would do with the 1st Cavalry and assist them, or they'd assist me.
Mm-hmm. And when you say go out to the field, do you mean for interviewing or for?
Well, to encircle a village and then go through the entire village one by one to make sure everybody that was there was properly documented, to talk to them to see when the Viet Cong were there, see if we could get names. Occasionally we'd find weapons or we'd find somebody that was still there and then arrest them. Take them back and the Vietnamese was terrible.
And this was under the sort of umbrella of the Phoenix program, yes?
Yeah, right.
Okay, and so how long did you do that sort of day-to-day of going to villages, finding either Northerners or Viet Cong? How long did that last?
Until I left.
And when was that?
I guess it was in May, June or July.
So summer of 68,
yeah. Late spring, early summer, 68.
Okay, and while you were in Vietnam, did you ever get to leave? I know sometimes soldiers would get a week to see family or to travel. Did you ever get to experience anything like that?
They had what they call R&R, rest and recreation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my wife flew to Honolulu, and I flew down to what was called Cameron Bay, and then to Honolulu. And this was before the Tet Offensive.
Okay. And was that a full week?
I think we probably saw each other for 5 days. I was gone a week because it took a day to get down and then a day to get back.
Okay.
To my unit.
And in Vietnam, did you make any close friendships?
They were close when we were there. And, we each left at different times whenever our year was up. But my commanding officer, my last 3 months, was a Major John Sally Kashmir, and I saw him being interviewed.
Excuse me, could you repeat that name, the audio?
Yeah, Major John Sally Kashmir.
Okay, and where was he from?
I think he grew up in Hungary, but he was a U.S. Army major who later became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Oh, wow. And
first foreign-born to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And when he was being interviewed by the Senate, I've never watched C-SPAN. And that particular day, I happened to turn it on, and I saw him, and I wrote him a nice long letter, and he wrote back. And that was the only contact I had with anybody recently.
Oh, so this was recent. On
C-SPAN. It was during the Clinton years.
Okay.
So
a good time after Vietnam, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then another, you talk about friendships. There are some, I'd have to look his name up, but a guy about 8 years ago started pulling together people that had served in Quang Tri in the different services. And so he contacted me, and he's bringing back friendships himself, and that's been kind of interesting. And then Major Shali Kashpili became a 3-star general, and one of his aides was writing a book about him, and he called me, and he is, the general has since passed away, but this guy did write a book about him, and mentioned his time in Triophon in the unit. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah. What else, any other sort of memories that you have of your time, either things that stick out to you or just anything?
When I worked in Quang Tri, there was another group like mine that lived in civilian housing in city called Hue, H-U-E, on the Perfume River, and I got to know them pretty well, and went down to Hue a couple of times to share resources and analysis, and during the Tet Offensive, two of those guys were captured by the Viet Cong, and my understanding is they both escaped within 2 or 3 weeks, but that's all I know. I can't remember the names.
Uh-huh. Wow. And then, do you ever... Oh, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, and when I was doing all these... what would you call them? Small one-day operations. My radio man, a Vietnamese, did step on a landmine, and I had to call in to get a medevac, and that was the only incident where we weren't inside the compound where one of my men got injured. We never got shot at during the day. We got shot at plenty of times at night in the compound after that. Never.
What was that like?
It was unnerving.
What would, I mean, how do you respond to that when you're under fire at night? Do you attack back, or do you try to, I mean, what is the process or the drill for that?
Well, if you can identify where it's coming from, then you'd call in artillery or what we generally recall on a secure communication system and give them coordinates. And they'd either bring in what they call the Dragon Lady, which is a big airplane that had all these, not all, about four or five machine gun cannons, and they would strafe wherever we would tell them to strafe, or they would bomb. That's what we would do.
Are you all right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't know if you were reaching for some water, for a lozenge, or anything like that.
No.
Okay. Well, so then let's talk about the end of your tour. You did not opt for the second year. You just did the 365 days.
Well, it probably would help to just explain what, with about 3 weeks to go, a lot of my Phoenix work was done through the CIA.
Okay.
The head of the CIA province operation was kind of who I reported to. And if I needed any materials or anything like that, I didn't go through the Army. I was told to go through this man because he could get it much quicker and much easier.
Okay.
And so he invited me to a meeting in Da Nang. And they had a very nice steak dinner and had a, I guess, had a house, I think. I don't think it was at the officers' club. And complimented me on what I'd done and how I'd kind of set some good goals for other people, et cetera. And by the way, if I was interested, they could get me out of the Army within 3 days and make me a civilian and get paid the equivalent of an Army captain, and they would fly my wife to the Philippines, and I'd get to see her every month for a weekend. And I said, "But I assume that means that I have to stay in Vietnam." And they said, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to bother asking my wife because I know what the answer will be."
Mm-hmm.
So I left about 2 weeks later on very good terms. I mean, I was honored that they would ask, but I had no interest.
Mm-hmm.
And like when I was getting ready to graduate from OCS, I had to fill out another dream sheet. And the Army Intelligence had a military base outside of Boston called Fort Devens. And they generally tell you, don't put your first choice first because the Army will never give it to you. But I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to take any chances. I'm going to put down Fort Devens, and then I'll put it to other places. And mm-hmm. to my pleasant surprise, Fort Devens came back, and this was a great chance for my wife to get to know my mother and for me to spend more time with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out very well. So I was there for my last 8 months.
And did you...
I was still in the intelligence operation, but this time I was a first lieutenant. And we were doing background investigations on people in the U.S. Army and writing up reports.
Were these people who were under suspicion of some sort of...
No. If they wanted a security clearance.
Oh, okay.
No, if it was somebody under suspicion, that would have been the military police that would do that, and the CID, mm-hmm. the Criminal Investigation Division. We were strictly doing security clearances, like for Hillary.
For who?
Like Hillary Clinton today.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought, but I just wanted to make sure. Okay.
But it was strictly for military people to mm-hmm. get access to different levels of classifications.
Oh, okay. And so you were in Boston. Your wife, did you live on the base or?
Yeah, they had officer housing there, and we had a split duplex, and got to know the other couple next door, and we stayed friends with them, and I'm still friends with the man and his wife. My first wife passed away about 10 years ago, but we had a good bond with the couple next to us, which wasn't always the case, and we just happened to enjoy each other's company, so it worked out well.
Well, so let's just talk about your last few months in the Army. You decided not to stay on or have a military career.
Yeah, again, the commanding officer on that base, we had a discussion, I think, about a month before I left, and he, again, made it clear that if I stayed, not again, but he himself said, you're on a clear path to become a captain within the next 4 to 5 months, and would love to keep you here. And I said, I do enjoy the military, and it's been very good to me, and I feel very confident in what I'm doing. I was also involved in doing computer work there. But I said, now, if I do continue on, my chances of going back to Vietnam are about 90%. He said, yes. Mm-hmm. But this time I did talk to my wife, because she was right there. She said no. She was ready to go back to work, for me to go back to Pittsburgh with Gulf. Mm-hmm. We did.
And what, that was 1969, do you remember around what month that would have been that you finished your service?
It would have been around June.
June 1969. And did you ever stay,
it must have been earlier than that, because my son was born in June of 69, so it was probably May of 69.
Okay. So end of the spring in 1969?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I know you said you wrote letters to the general and you were in contact with some people, but did you ever do anything like join any sort of veteran groups besides your volunteer work, just anything for yourself or other people that you, a way to talk to other people who had been serving at the same time as you?
I did nothing like that for the next 50 years. In the last 4 years, I've done a lot.
And like what?
Well, I've done volunteer work. You read the chapter that we wrote for our class did.
Could you, for future listeners, could you talk about that in this interview?
Talk about which?
Talk about the chapter that you wrote, if you'd like.
Yeah, I think I've covered the basic message was that I matured thoroughly by going to Vietnam and was happy to serve, but happy to leave.
mm-hmm. And that was in the class of 64 book.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And was this volunteer work spurred by anything in particular, or was it something that you just realized you had a passion for?
No, a Marine, young Marine, came and talked to our Bible study group.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a little over two years ago, and mentioned that 22 veterans a day were committing suicide.
Wow.
And I was absolutely astounded. And I said, so what can we do to help? And he said, if you're a veteran, you can help people going through the court system. And that's when I started volunteering very actively.
What kind of volunteer work is that with the court system? Do you go to court with them, or what exactly do you do?
It's called a mentor system, and you're required to have been in the military, not necessarily in combat, but it helps. And you meet with them at least once a day, once a week, and do show up in court with them when they show up. I have since become a squad leader, so I have 12 mentors working underneath me. So I go to court every Monday, and they only go to court when their mentee shows up. But you're there to help the veteran in any way that they need it, whether it means just being a good listener, which is the first part, and then helping them in any way you can, other than don't provide them a lot of funding because you probably won't get it back.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like really great work. I know a lot of veterans, especially with the Vietnam War, struggled because of the public backlash to the war. Did you ever have to deal with anything like that, whether it was protesters or just people in your personal life disagreeing with the war?
Yes, I think the second night I was back in Pittsburgh, my in-laws had a very nice welcome home party for friends of theirs in the neighborhood and any friends that we had. And this woman next door who I'd known fairly well, she had known my wife since she grew up. And she was pleasant enough when I left to go in the military, and she came up on the patio where I was standing. And she, after about a minute of just simple chit-chat, she said, I think it's terrible that you were in that war. I don't know why anybody would serve in that war. And can you explain it? And I said, I'm serving my country, ma'am, and if that doesn't make sense to you, then I don't see how I can get across to you. She said, well, that's a stupid answer. And I just turned. That was it. I mean, that was my welcome home for one neighbor, and we were never friends. I mean, my wife heard the whole thing. She was insulted like I was. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. I went to one. My insurance agent had sent a bunch of stuff, collected a bunch of things to provide to the locals, and so I promised her I'd give a talk when I came back. So I gave two or three talks about life in Vietnam. I'd done a lot of slides of, you know, what life was like, you know, not military wise, just how people got around, what they ate, and what the steam wing was like. So I did that a couple of times for local groups, and that was about it. And okay. My children rarely asked me about it because I could tell that I didn't want to talk about it. Now they ask me all the time.
How many children do you have?
Three children.
I know you said your son, who was born right after you had gotten out of the Army, was that your oldest child?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then sons, daughters afterwards?
Then I had another son about 2 years later, and then a daughter about 5 years later. And she was born in London.
Oh, what year was that? What were you doing in London?
Gulf Oil. I got transferred to London for a year.
Okay, so, wow. Thank you so much. We've covered Vietnam. If there is anything else that you'd like to talk about at all?
No, I've kind of run my stream, and if you have any questions after you look at your notes or anything, feel free to call back or email back. And if you get any questions from reading that chapter, or if there's any disagreements with what I said, let me know.
No, okay. Well, I'm going to end this recording at 11:19.
Okay.